From a young age, Fokke de Jong has always followed his entrepreneurial spirit. And while studying law in Amsterdam in the late 90s, a chance encounter with a contact with a pipeline to top Italian textile makers, he decided to create a new model for menswear. Launched in 2000 out of the boot of a car in Holland as a direct-to-consumer brand, Suit Supply has found success in building a great marriage between online and bricks-and-mortar retail. An early innovator of e-commerce shopping, Suit Supply has always offered customers the chance to pick up their garments in person to have them perfectly tailored. Amidst a flooded online and high street retail market, Suit Supply has focused on steady growth, which has allowed de Jong to maintain 100% ownership of the company. With shops across Asia, Europe, Australia, and the US, the brand launched its 100th store in Boston earlier this year. Here's my conversation with Fokke de Jong, founder and CEO of Suit Supply, discussing growth, his role in the company today, and plans to move into women's wear.
I was always inspired by, first of all, entrepreneurship, and I liked aesthetical stuff, like beautiful stuff, like architecture, design. But I also liked to make money, right? Or money, at least have the freedom to do what you like. I think that's the main driver for a lot of entrepreneurs. It's not so much being or getting a lot of money or being rich. It's just having the freedom to do what you want. I was inspired by that from a young age. I remember I was actually recalling that with my parents a few weeks ago, that when I was 8 or 9, I wanted to sort of start my own company. And I was in school and they did sort of a, for a charity, collected old paper. And people always took the old paper and put it in a big container. And to buy, I don't know, a VCR or something for the school. I was like, oh, wow, you can get money for... So I built a little cart behind my bicycle. And I think I went down, up and down like 1,000 times before I had a container filled with old paper that I sold. And I don't know, a few $100, maybe $1,000, got me my first amplifier. And then I got a drive-in show. And that was when I was 8. I think, and I started doing that, all that kind of stuff. I had all these kind of little businesses, pinball machines. When I was 15 or 16, I was when the Iron Curtain fell, and I was in high school, we suddenly had a business in Czechoslovakia where we imported milk powder and sold it to Saudi Arabia. And we were like hugely successful for 6 months until obviously they found out, because we were just sending out faxes, that we were just a bunch of guys with a fax machine, and we went bust. So that's the moment I decided to go to college, which was interesting on one hand, but it also took me a lot of time, I guess. And I was a little hard to concentrate in college. But because I needed a job sort of to get me to college and make some money. And so at some point I ran into a guy that worked with some factory in Italy, and that got me connected to suiting. And they made a beautiful product, right? And I always liked clothing, and I liked design, like I said. And so I set up a little business out of the trunk of my car, basically, to sell suits to my fellow students that needed their first work suit, or on Friday afternoons, organizing sort of Tupperware parties in offices where... The funny thing was, you went into the office and said to the secretary, gee, these guys in your office all like they could need a suit upgrade. And obviously they always agreed. And I said, well, we can do that if you can organize something on Friday afternoon. So I had these Tupperware parties. And it got me to college, but it also gave me an insight how sort of old-fashioned and inefficient that whole luxury tailoring industry was working at the time. It was very beautiful little factories in Italy that made a nice product, but then went to trade shows, had agents, and that sold these products to all the, let's say, the independent retail stores. So a lot of people in between before the product actually ended up to the consumer with a lot of inefficiencies. We all know this, how this works, a typical direct-to-consumer. But at that time, it was 2000, and direct-to-consumer obviously was done by the Zaras and the H&M of the world for the middle, let's say, quality segment, but not so much for the luxury. And it was also when online came up. And basically, I have to take one step back. I almost finished college. I started to work for Procter & Gamble because that was something everybody was at that time, like, you have to work for a big corporate. I lasted a week. And I was like, I mean, there's still the thing that you want as an entrepreneur, and I think from young of age, to have your own freedom was sort of what instilled me to quit that and start out to say, okay, I have this connection to the industry. I see what we can do there, how to disrupt it. And I also like the product and what I can do with it. So we just started a direct-to-consumer online business in suiting, which went pretty okay. But then we thought, you know what, it was a little bit ahead of the curve, right? At that time, everybody in online thought that if you buy something online, it should be cheaper than if you buy something in the store. That was the perception at the time. So we decided to open a store next to it where you can sort of pick up your stuff, have a tailor in there. And we opened it between next to the highway, almost next to a gas station, between the two busiest cities in Holland, between Amsterdam and Rotterdam. And everybody thought we were completely out of our minds. You can't sell suit next to the highway, and it's very luxury. And it was so crazy that we got a lot of press. Everybody wanted to write about this crazy guy that had a suit shop next to the highway and did online and you could pick up there. It was omnichannel before the word omnichannel was even invented. I think that was Best Buy in 2006 or something that came up with that word. I needed to be successful because I had $50,000, I think, to start with. I think it was even less. So we had a few weeks to break even. But because this place was so crazy and everybody wrote up about it and we got great PR, the business started to fly off.
I want to just step back a little bit. You said you were able to find, you know, efficiencies in the market, and that sort of was your inspiration, where you saw potential, somewhere you could go in and fill that. Where did you find the market where you fit in, or where did you want to fit in when you first started?
The mantra of our brand is actually we didn't want to fit in. And it's still actually the mantra of our brand, don't just fit in, find your own perfect fit is what we try to say. And that's true for my mentality, but it's also something that then becomes part of the DNA of the brand. Like I said, the first example, to open a luxury suit store next to the highway was not something people normally would have thought about into luxury. We're successful because we are doing three things differently. First of all, I mean, obviously the direct-to-consumer thing is not really that different. I mean, there's a lot of people doing that. But I think also we combined that with a destination location strategy. That first example, we iterated that into what we do right now. Find locations that are off the beaten track. Don't rely on traffic. It's very simple, but if you go into if you want to be between the usual suspects and what all the luxury brands do, you end up on the same row and you end up paying the same kind of rents. We quickly found out that by online, we could drive traffic to our stores. If we made a beautiful product and invest our energy there and have actually a service, men are not shoppers. They're not browsers. They will go out and find you. We end up now with beautiful villas in old Greenwich, rooftops in Chicago, beautiful building a villa in Shanghai, like really nice places where you go in and like, whoa, I want to hang out here, right? I want to spend some time here. It's relaxing. And on the other hand, it gives a lot of platform for our products. I mean, it's spacious, so it's cool. But if you look at the P&L, it also works out from a profit perspective. Mm. That's only one example where we said we don't fit in with the usual suspects. You just think, okay, we want to be here, we need to be there, etc. That's important for our brand. We set ourselves apart and go basically our own way. And sometimes we're around where all the usual suspects are, but then we get creative and go in upper floors and use beautiful spaces like in Soho or here. The other thing is the mentality of tailoring, which is actually, if you look at the history, right, it's one of the most essential but also distinguishing pieces of men's fashion. But a lot of brands made it send out a strong message of conformity, if you talk about tailoring. I mean, think about Hugo Boss or all of these brands. It's always, let's say, the successful guy with a mobile phone next to a BMW. And it's a message of conformity or that is logical. I mean, Hugo Boss, it was a uniform producer for the army. That's how a lot of brands in tailoring this whole conformity thing approach it. I think we send out a message of nonconformity and go exactly the other way. That also gives the brand way more interesting energy. That's not only in how we communicate, but also in our collections. We experiment more. I wouldn't say a lot of the conformity brands take themselves hugely serious in that. And I think we play around with it a little bit more. We try to be, because we like that. It gives more energy to the brand. So we bring a fashion edge, a cool edge, but also on the business model, a way that allows us to bring a high-end product in an exciting way for a very attainable price.
I'm just interested in, again, early days when you're talking about driving people to the stores as the main sort of goal of direct-to-consumer. And you were sort of an early adapter, I guess, in this direct-to-consumer world. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking about tailoring and high-end suits, what was the approach there? Were you always offering that service, or how did you make sure people were, you know, getting a chance to see and try on the product?
We always had, and we still have that in all our stores, tailors in the stores that are actually do all the alterations, most of the times as you wait, which was very interesting for people because it gives you this sort of instant gratification. Obviously, if you want to have it completely tailored and make a whole suit for you, we do that too. Driving people to the store, the question we always get is, okay, so you guys are destination. You must spend a lot of money in marketing. We don't. It's basically very simple. We need a small group of people that get acquainted with our brand and just tell the word on. When we started, it was a little harder because you start with a very small snowball and you throw it off a mountain and it takes some time to get bigger. Now, we just opened a store on the other end of the world in Sydney, beautiful 8,000 square feet store, and we already have a following, like a very informed following. These are people that are, let's say, early adapters that are in the know about this product. So you have a little bigger snowball already in that market than the other end of the world that we just have to throw down on the mountain and we can start going.
Getting into the market, as we've said, of high-quality suit making and tailoring can be a tricky world, I imagine, with the established labels. But we live in a world where people demand so much. So many more people are shopping online, but they demand so much more of labels and want more of a customer interaction to be really sold on that label. So when you get someone in the store, what is that experience like when you're trying to sell them the brand? What is their experience like walking into a shop?
First of all, the common denominator of what we do is basically everything that has a jacket on. So that could be something that's you wear casually in the weekend or something you have to wear to the office or something that you just wear because you like it. Like there's a lot of people always tell me tailoring is dying and all that kind of stuff. It's actually not. Men are spending more and more money on clothing. And they spend more money on something that's nice, right? If you walk into a store, you'll see that, right? You immediately have the feeling that you want to touch something, which is the nice thing about a store. Right? People orientate online. We have a big online business, but if we open a store in the market, we see that cannibalizes on our online business in the beginning. So people apparently want to have stores for these kind of a product. So the experience is you walk in and you get inspired by a lot of course, mannequins. You see a tailor inside, and you just want to touch stuff. But it's not something where we leave you to your own devices. It's a high-touch environment on the product, but also how we, of course, help our customers. And we have a lot of people in the stores, of all of our people, actually, that are very knowledgeable about what we do. That's why we focus on what we call tailoring, right? And what's very important there, of course, is the quality of the product, but it's basically all around fit. That again, is why we say, don't just fit in, find your own perfect fit as the mantra of our brand, because that's where we can add value with the quality of our people and how we train them. We could do probably 100 different extensions to the brand, right? Going to very casual, going to all kinds of, but it's very hard then to leverage the knowledge that we train our people for. People in our stores have been, we have a whole academy in all the continents in Asia, in Europe, and in the Americas called Suit School. And people, before everybody, even a part-timer that works in San Francisco gets flown in to our Suit School, they get to know everything about sizing, about quality of the fabrics. So to make sure our customers get a perfect fit. So you'll feel that there's somebody that's knowledgeable. You'll also feel, hopefully, that it's somebody that doesn't want to try and maximize the transaction. What we incentivize people on is not only on, because it's always trade-off, but not primarily on sales, but on their, basically on their service, on their NPS values. If you buy something, what is, we already do that for almost 10 years, we mail you a receipt, and it starts with a very simple question, like an Uber, if you've been helped, good, bad, or excellent, right? This is something, it's very simple, but that's where we rate people on. People are incentivized on not just the sale, but also the retention of the sale. This customer is coming back. And we put a lot of technology and CRM intelligence in there to make sure that you feel that there's somebody there, basically very simple, that knows their stuff and that generally wants to have a long-term relationship with you. Not just because it's fluffy, but it's also because if it's in their interest. It's in their interest to make sure that if he reaches out to you after a few weeks, how your products is, are holding up and how everything's going, he said, I want to buy something more with this guy. We're talking about bricks and mortar here, but these journeys are completely intertwined. For instance, you could be browsing on our website and and we could see that you're not finding something immediately. And then you could choose, a pop-up comes up that says, hey, this is Joe. I'm seeing you're in New York and you're looking at some suits. I have these and these available for you. If you want to pop into the store, I might be able to help you. Or vice versa, if you bought something in the store, you would want to put some stuff aside or in your fitting room, you could set up a fitting room virtually, and that's what we're working on right now, and have that ready for you in the store with your favorite sales guy. It's not that these worlds are completely intertwined. They obviously are completely together. Because we were founded as an online business, we were forced, obviously, to build on the technology and the infrastructure, where a lot of retailers are actually struggling to bring these worlds together. We already had that in the basis. These were not different worlds from the start.
Did that sort of set a pattern for the scaling and growth that you've had? Do you think? Is that quite careful? Because obviously, you've just opened earlier this summer your 100th shop, but perhaps you could have had many more. But is sort of been a careful growth?
Yeah, we believe in relative growth. Question I'm always getting is, oh, great, you're in the U.S. Why are you opening in Asia? Why don't you just open, we have, I think 35 stores in the U.S. Why don't you open 100 stores? Because then I have to put a lot of pressure on the relative growth curve. It's harder to grow from 2 to 4 stores than it is to grow from 4 to 10 or from 10 to 20. The reason is the service element is so important to train people to make sure you maintain culture. There's almost a natural sort of growth curve in there that you can accelerate if you want to. You have to throw a lot of money on it and you add a lot of more risk. So what we choose to do is say, okay, we make a more gradual growth curve that's relative to this, to the base we have in a country. But in the meantime, we put a little seed already in another area. Like, for instance, now we do in China. We started a few years ago, 1 store, 2 stores, put a little online environment. And now we have 5. So now we can grow from 5 to 10 to 20 without putting a lot of pressure on that management team and that system. The same in Europe, the same in America. So if you put it all together, then aggregated, obviously your growth curve starts to accelerate. But you don't put too much stress on your, say, on your management, on your services.
From setting up the business and doing the sort of Tupperware parties, as you said, and then opening the first shop, over the past 18 years, the growth seems quite measured and carefully thought about, but obviously your role in the company has also sort of grown slowly along with that as well. What's your day-to-day like now? What's your role?
I don't know if it changed that much. Of course, probably it's gotten some big, gotten a little bigger. It's gotten more international. There's a lot of, unfortunately, we have a lot of people that grown with us, but there's also a lot of people, obviously, with growth that come in. More and more time, I think, in my role is to talk about, I mean, strategy when you're with 10 people on a table is not really a talking point because everybody sort of knows what the strategy is and what we're going. But to align people more on what our most important goals are, that's become differently. I mean, I have to articulate that more and more, make sure that new people get onboarded. But other than that, I think what still is in a growing company, and I mean, we've been growing with about 20 to 30% a year, but very constantly over the last 10 years. And then what always happens is you have to fly on one end, think through and be a little strategic about stuff. You have to fly, sometimes you have to fly in 37,000 feet, but immediately also, you have to fire a Scud missile, we always say, into the details. Because in growth companies, everything sort of changes a little bit all the time. And stuff and processes that worked 2 years ago might fail now. So if there's a little thing going wrong somewhere, it's always like figuring that out, taking that thread and start pulling at it and figuring out what's going on there and how we can improve that. And that all starts in the detail. And that's also the hardest thing to find in growing companies, finding people that have the mental elasticity to fly on 37,000 feet and go into every little detail if they need to.
We've talked about the success you've had by focusing on what you really do well so your customers really understand what the brand is about and what they're getting when they engage with you. But I'm curious about sort of next steps. You talked about briefly not getting involved in too many side bits, but focusing on the suit and the jacket. Will there be other facets of the company, women's wear?
So I go back to our mantra, and it says, find your perfect fit. So it's all about a luxury product where fit and make is very important and everything that goes around that look. So that's why I always say the jacket, it could be a jeans with a beautiful cashmere jacket. And obviously we sell knits and we sell everything that goes with a more elegant contemporary look. And it has to have luxury in it because that's where we can be different also from an attainable price point of view. And we believe, and what is luxury? It's not a big name or a big logo on it. It's about a product that you actually feel that there's, and what the Japanese say, they believe if somebody put a lot of energy in a product or they believe the product in itself will become or get some kind of a personality, right? It will get soul. And customers feel that. I mean, if you go and you see a product which has a beautiful fabric, it's beautiful constructed, and people actually put time and effort in all the details, they wouldn't be able to point it out what exactly it is, but they feel that that product will have soul. And I think that's the first thing. If we look at our products, that's what we need to be able to do. So if we go into something that we're not able to put that soul into, it's not for us. We looked into, okay, at the end of the line, where would we expand to? It has to be able to, that we leverage our knowledge about construction and how to make a product. Because it's not only about a fabric. It's also, especially, that's where the complication is, what it's inside, right? To make something feel nice or fit nice, it's about how it's made. If you look at our tailoring, our jacket, we use traditional Italian techniques where we, something doesn't get form from itself. You have to put something inside to give it form. And we give it form by putting thin layers of cotton, where old techniques with horse hair and camel hair are used to give that product form. These kind of techniques and these kind of, where can we leverage them? That's why we end up, okay, there's still a huge amount of growth for us in the men's business. But if there's any way that we could potentially maybe look into it and leveraging it, then it might be the women's business. And I'm still it's a beta project for us, but we are sort of surprised And maybe it's, I don't know, maybe it's the time, but the amount of interest that we're getting. And because I was like, oh, everybody was actually warning me, never ever go into the women's business because it's so different and it's more fashion risks and all that kind of stuff. And women are shopped very differently. Well, I have to be honest, if I found that they're actually not that different. It's pretty similar. The concept there is way more, is even more differentiating than it is for men. I mean, we've been having Savile Row for hundreds of years where you walk in and you have this whole tailoring and fitting experience and all that kind of stuff. But if you look for women, there's not one single place that's specialized in that. So women that walk into our store, they have they feel that there's enormous depth in basically suiting and tailoring and all that kind of stuff. Also with that same kind of energy we bring into the men's. And on the other hand, that focus on fit and expertise and people that are not just looking at styling, but also how and have it how it fits and have a tailor in the store, etc. It's a concept where women are extremely surprised and enthusiastic about. And it's basically, it's funded on the same fundamentals as it is the men's.
That's all the time we have for on today's show. Thank you to Funke DeYoung for sharing the story of Suit Supply. And thank you to Kieran Matthew Banerjee, who mixed and edited this show. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.